I titled this talk, Surprise, Surprise, and I'll tell you why. Do you encounter people who have firm ideas of where truth is and where the facts are, and then you find out they're completely off base, but they're so convinced and they're so confident in their truth, not the real truth? And so we see that in the area of Christianity as well. A lot of people think they know what Christianity is, and a lot of them have negative ideas, negative truths that they carry. So we're going to do five of these truths. Now, there are more than that, but five areas in which people have an idea of Christianity. It's just not true, but they're negative. So here's the first one. Christianity is anti-woman. Here's the second one. Christianity has supported destruction of the environment. It's part of the Judeo-Christian worldview that's gone out and just burned and pillaged everything in nature. Third one. Christianity opposes science. It's always trying to snuff out science. Here's a fourth one. Christianity is horrified by anything to do with the body and, are you ready? Sex. Ugh. Christianity hates that. And then fifth, Christianity is irrational. It's a leap in the dark. It's just faith. It's just blind leaping and hoping that there's something out there. So these are five areas that people think Christianity represents or is, that are, these things are absolutely not true. So we're going to take a look at each of the five. Let's start with the first one. Christianity is anti-woman. Well, after all, people say Paul wants women to be subservient to men. Early church fathers said derogatory things about women. And then the alternate, of course, is that there were these pagan societies that were so much friendlier to women and treated women so well. So these are the ones that we're going to say, surprise, that's not the truth. So were ancient societies friendly to women? Absolutely not. I don't have the time now to go into that, but if you look at Greece and you look at Rome and even Hebrew culture, they are so patriarchal, so strongly pro-men and putting women in their place and giving them very few rights at all. Now, what about modern societies? Okay, so those were the ancient societies. How are modern societies doing? Well, what about, let's take China as an example. Foot binding, was that fair to women? Absolutely not. Have you ever seen a picture of what a woman's foot looked like after foot binding? Terrible. What about India? Well, India used to have sati, the practice in which after a man died, his widow was expected to commit suicide by jumping into the funeral pyre. Many of them did, but the ones who refused were outcasts in their society. What about Muslim countries today? Well, do I have to explain much about that? Absolutely not. We see things all the time, whether it's female genital mutilation, whether it's refusing to let women drive, whether the Quran says men can strike women. I mean, there are a lot of things that, of course, make women second-rate citizens in Muslim countries. What about Christianity? It does no good just to say, well, other societies are bad. We have to say, well, but has Christianity done much better? Yes. Look at the New Testament stories and look at how Jesus interacts with women. Let's just take a few examples. The Samaritan woman. Jesus comes up to a woman that was considered dirty. Samaritans were dogs to the Jews. And Jesus talks to her and he reveals who he is. He treats her seriously. He wasn't supposed to be sitting there talking to her. Later on, we get stories of Jesus interacting with Mary and Martha. He's willing to teach these women. He's willing to say it's more important to be taught than to go running around doing homemaking things. What about Jesus' appearances after the resurrection? Who are the first ones who encounter it and believe it? It's women. And of course, in those days, that was something to have women be your testimony for a case, a witness. It was very, very different. What about Paul and women? He treated them very well. Yes, it does say women are supposed to be, as wives, women are supposed to be subservient to men, but take a look in the same passage, that's in Ephesians. What does it say about the men? The men are supposed to love their wives, the husbands, are supposed to love their wives as Christ loved the church. Well, how did Christ love the church? Totally sacrificial. Supposed to put everything that he wants on the back burner and honor her and sacrifice for her and do the best he can for her. So again, I don't have the time to go into that, but there are books that explore some of the passages people take out of context to say Paul sees women as second rate. Absolutely not. In fact, he says there's no difference between male and female when it comes to the church and the way God sees us. In the early church, you had women like Apphia and Nympha and Priscilla and Phoebe. In fact, Phoebe apparently was a deacon at this time. These women led different studies. They were in their homes. The early church was extremely pro-woman. Women were allowed to worship right alongside the men. They were baptized the same way. They heard the same lessons. And then over the years, if we come from the apostolic times to today, what do we find? Women have been far more active than men when it comes to serving and doing things for the church. They're instructed, like I said, the same as men. They're baptized like men. They participated in the Lord's Supper. They prayed and sang with men in worship settings. And at this time, men had laws that said they had absolute power over children and wives. But these laws were repealed under Christianity. There was more freedom for women under Christianity of when they could marry and who they could marry. In fact, one historian said this, the birth of Jesus was the turning point in the history of women. So can we say women have been treated always well in the church? No. There are certainly occasions where that's not been the case. But overall, if you look at the New Testament, if you look at the founding documents of Christianity, they're all favorable to women. Number two, so there's the first one. Are women created, seen as second rate in Christianity? Absolutely not. Number two, here's another thought that people have. They think is true. Christianity is not good for the environment. Well, they get blamed. Christians are blamed for environmental problems. Christians are arrogant when it comes to nature. We're supposed to whip it into shape. Other religions and cultures have been far more ethical, far more fair-minded, have treated nature far better. Oh, really? Surprise! Other cultures and religions have not been kinder to nature. American Indians actually would burn big parts of the forest for something that they didn't really need that much burnt. They would drive thousands of animals to their deaths when they only needed a limited number of things to eat or to take from those animals. Animists, Eastern religions, new spirituality movements, they're not kind to nature. They have done some terrible things in the name of nature. And secular technology, it's secular technology that's brought many of the environmental problems that we have. Well, what does Christianity say regarding the environment? Well, God says creation is good. God says he's done something beautiful out there. And nature and people are seen to be extremely valuable. Nature, valuable too. But then the fall comes. And Christianity believes that because of the fall, not only has the human race, but nature has fallen. It's been affected strongly by what happened to us. Maybe I shouldn't use that word fallen, but it's had problems because of us. But what does the Bible teach in the New Testament? That nature, as well as people, will be redeemed in the future, heavens and earth. And the key, of course, people say, well, what about Genesis 1:27-28, where it says subdue? So that makes people think of big earth movers coming in and tearing out trees and strip mining and things like that. But the phrase there suggests stewardship, being a caretaker. So even back in Genesis, it's the responsibility of humans to be caretakers for this world. Well, here's a third area that is raised as an issue regarding Christianity. It opposes science. Now, what do we hear? There's been a war, an eternal war between religion and science. And Christianity is just one of the religions, but it's been anti-science. And that before the Enlightenment, there was no science. After all, the church ran things back in the Middle Ages, and so they're often referred to as the Dark Ages. Superstition reigned. How did it reign? Because of the church, because of Christianity. Then they trot out stories about Giordano Bruno and Galileo, and they'll talk about these men being persecuted and put to death and enchained and imprisoned and all because of their scientific beliefs, persecuted terribly. And then the idea is that science grew only after Christianity was weakened. Right? So those are the stories that are out there. Oh, surprise. What's the truth? Actually, it's the Judeo-Christian worldview that's responsible for modern science. How so? Well, consider how God created. He said everything was good. He was separate from his creation. He made us in his image, and that everything was good out there. And so the idea is, if we're people and we look out at nature, we say it's okay to cut a tree down, for example, because we're not hurting God. God's not in that tree. He's separate from his creation. If God gave us a mind, then God was good. God was an engineer. We must have some capabilities, certainly not on the level of God, but we must have some capabilities of using our minds. And so there's a tremendous optimism that happens. For example, Kepler, who understood and figured out the way the planets move around the sun, said he was just thinking God's thoughts after him. And so it's not a case of science coming about despite Christianity. It's science coming about because of Christianity. Even secularists, historians especially, have noted this. There's no such thing. Here's another point about Christianity and science. There's no such thing as the Dark Ages. Historians these days are suggesting that that phrase get replaced. Why? Because it was actually a time of great invention and creativity. So there were no Dark Ages. What about Bruno and Galileo? What's the real story? Bruno involved himself in dark arts, and he said some things that were extremely off base when it came to Christianity. And so he did get put to death. And I'm not saying that was the right decision by the church. No, that was terrible. He did get put to death. But here's the catch. He didn't get put to death as a martyr for science. He was put to death because he was a heretic. Again, I'm not saying that that was a good thing, but I just think we ought to clear the air here. It's not a case of him being a martyr to science. What about Galileo? Galileo was actually never tortured, and what he was doing was attacking the Aristotle's ideas of how the whole universe worked. And the church had kind of bought into Aristotle, and they got a little nervous when he went after Aristotle. And if you read some of the historical writings about what went on, then you find out that Galileo was pretty obnoxious. He attacked the Pope. And again, he got himself in a lot of hot water because of his own personality. Science grew during the Reformation. Now here are evangelical, Bible-reading Christians. You'd think if Christianity hated science, that would be the time they would stop it. But no. The Royal Society, for example, in England, formed during this time because of Christians. And many of these early scientists, you can run down the list of any of the early scientists, the famous scientists, they were Christians. And I think something really fascinating, I have a separate talk on this, modern scientific discoveries are actually leading people toward God. That it's a going proposition these days. So I won't spend the time on that now, but everything from the discovery of the Big Bang to the discovery of so much precision as far as the conditions for life. Everything seems to be fine-tuned for life. And a lot of people are realizing that fine-tuned quality is so particular that it can't happen by random processes. So anyway, surprise, it's a very different picture of Christianity and science. Here's a fourth area. Oh, Christians hate anything physical. They're only interested in the soul. They hate sex. They find the body shameful. And we've heard things like that before. Think about the Puritans. Okay, well, surprise. The idea of being against the physical rather than the spiritual is not from Christianity. It's from the Greeks and those who followed Plato. Plato believed the mind, the soul was important, the body was nothing, and put it down. And God created the physical world. Christians bought into that idea. It was good. The body is important in the Bible. Our resurrection, for example, is going to be a physical one, not just a spiritual resurrection. We don't treat the physical as some kind of illusion like Eastern religions. They call it Maya. We say, no, the physical is real. Jesus proved the value of the flesh. He came in the flesh. That's where we get that word incarnation. Carne is meat, or the physical quality. Jesus came. So we celebrate that. The Reformation comes along during the 1600s and 1700s, 1500s even. And they rejected celibacy. They rejected that. And these are Bible-believing Christians, serious, fundamental Christians. They rejected celibacy. Studies show, for example, religious people are more satisfied with their sex. And in the Bible, sex and marriage is given a high role. Think about Jesus and all. Many times, the comparison is of marriage. He's looking for the bride. The bride will be the church. And so we get a lot of positives on marriage and sex in the Bible. All right, number five. This will be the last one. We could go through a lot more. But what about this? Christianity is irrational. Oh, really? Well, here's what they say. It's only science that gives us real knowledge, and Christianity is that famous leap in the dark. It takes blind faith. Oh, really? Surprise! Biblical faith is not that way at all. Biblical faith is based on a three-step process. First, we look for evidence. When we find evidence, that gives us knowledge that we didn't have before. And based on that knowledge, we gain trust in God. Or Jesus, depending on what we're looking at in the Bible. Okay, so you got that three steps. There's evidence that's given. There's knowledge that's gained. The result is trust in God. So here's an Old Testament example. Moses. Remember the plagues? All right, well, in Exodus 14, here's what it says. And when the Israelites saw the great power the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him. Okay, let's go back and run through that. When they saw the power of the Lord, so they had evidence. They saw God doing these things. It says, they feared the Lord and put their trust in him. So they saw it, they gained a new insight of how powerful their God was, and they placed trust in him. So Moses didn't come to the children and say, trust me, I come from God, and he's a great God, and you need to follow him all the time. No, there are demonstrations that they could see. Evidence was given. How about a New Testament example? Well, Jesus, in Mark 2, forgives the sins of this man. And the people look and kind of scratch their heads. And Jesus says this, but that you may know, that's knowledge, but that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, .. What did he do? Well, first, think about this. He said to this person, your sins are forgiven. But nobody could see that, could they? Because that's not happening in the physical world. So people are maybe under their breaths or saying, yeah, right. I mean, I could say that. I could say, I forgive you your sins. But Jesus says, okay, I want you to know. I want you to know. I want you to gain knowledge that I can do that. I want you to trust me that I can do that. What evidence did he give? He healed that paralyzed man physically so people could see that. Again, so they saw the evidence, the healing. They gained the knowledge that this man has that kind of power, and they had trust that he could then forgive sins. And there are all sorts of Bible verses dealing with faith and thinking, not dealing with faith and not thinking. For example, Hebrews 11 starts this way. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. Do you hear the language here, not of leaping in the dark, but saying being sure, being certain? 1 Thessalonians 5 says this, test everything. It doesn't say take it on faith. 2 Timothy 1 says this, I know whom I have believed and am convinced. I know, not I'm guessing, I'm hoping, says I know. Philippians 4:8. Whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, think about such things. Think about what is true, not wish for something in the future. Think about the things that are true. 1 Corinthians 14:20. Stop thinking like children, but in your thinking be adults. So Paul is saying here, don't be a child and just wish and live in a dream world. Be adults. Think like adults. 2 Peter 3:1. I have written to stimulate you to wholesome thinking. Wholesome thinking. So over and over we see the challenge to us to think through things, not jump and hope that we catch on to something. Now, are secular people more rational? That's the story. Rationality belongs to the secular people, and it's Christians who are taking these blind leaps that are irrational. Well, let's ask that question again. Think about it. Are secular people more rational? No. Why is that? Well, think about this. If you're a secularist, where'd you come from? You came about accidentally. Why are we here? There's no purpose. How should we live? It's up to us. What's wrong with the human race? Well, we're just screwed up and it's somebody else's fault. What's our destiny? To be put in the ground 6 feet under and be worm food. Well, think about those implications. Would that make you want to be a rational person? No. And in fact, some famous rationalists, some famous secular people, have said, don't think too much about these things because it'll drive you crazy. It'll turn you into a depressed individual. If you really think about you're here for no purpose, you are an accident of the universe, you can't even trust your mind because that's part of this irrationality going on around you. Your destiny is hopefully live 50, 60, maybe 70 or 80 years, but then it's over. Everything you did is gone. Eventually, everything the human race has done will be gone. The entire universe will run out of energy, will run down. Nothing matters. You don't want to think very much about that. You can become way too depressed, so it's okay to be a thinking Christian. All right, so what's our summary? Christianity is actually very pro-woman, pro-environment, pro-science, pro-body and sex, and pro-rational. Nothing wrong with any of those things. So we've got the wrong picture if we're buying into that. And again, I've done talks on the science issue and Christianity as not a leap in the dark. So you can take a look at those in more depth if you'd like. What about some resources? Well, Nancy Piercy has a new book out called Love Thy Body. And that's powerful. That looks especially at how we treat the flesh, how we treat gender, how we treat all sorts of things dealing with a hookup culture, things like that. So you might find that one good. There's a book by Schmidt called How Christianity Changed the World. His spelling is S-C-H-M-I-D-T, How Christianity Changed the World. Then there's a book called Christianity on Trial by Carroll, C-A-R-R-O-L-L. There's a really good one about environmentalism. If you'd like to think about Christianity and the environment by Dan Story, S-T-O-R-Y. It's called Should Christians Be Environmentalists? See, a lot of people today are kind of scared off of that because there are some crazies out there that are extremes and worship nature, and of course that's not what we're talking about. And then here's one by a man named Kennedy, What If Jesus Had Never Lived? And finally, last one, Six Modern Myths, by a man named Samson, S-A-M-P-S-O-N, and the six is the letter, the number six, no letters, the number six, Modern Myths. And of course, contact me if you'd like some more information, gary@apologeticsforlife.org. And I'd be glad to talk to you about some of these issues, but we can hold our heads high. We have truth on our side. We have the facts, and we need to counteract some of these false stories that are out there circulating about Christianity.